Court's call sign had been Sierra 6. It was so ingrained in his consciousness, even after all this time, that he figured he would probably still answer to it if someone addressed him as such. But he was hoping he wouldn't be stuck in this unit long enough to remember Kylo 9 the same way. As the massive procession of Hawk's Brigade armor passed, two BMP-3 infantry fighting vehicles pulled over to the mercenaries and stopped, and the rear hatches on both opened. Court, Saunders, Braz, Brunetti, Vanwick, and Anders climbed into one of the vehicles, while the other six KWA men climbed into the other. The six men in Court's infantry fighting vehicle sat on two benches facing one another, and the three-man crew already on board waited for the signal to move out. The heavy, tracked machines folded back into the procession, leaving the base. And soon, Court could feel the driver make the hard left turn that indicated they'd departed through the main gate. It was low, cramped, dark, and hot inside the vehicle. It bounced up and down roughly on its chassis as soon as it encountered the first bumps outside the wire of the base, and it smelled like the interior had been sprayed down with engine lube and body odor. This was Court's first time inside a BMP-3, and to say he wasn't impressed would have been an understatement. He had been hoping to get some rest on the several hours' journey to the north, but now he couldn't imagine any way to pull that off. Court had never served in the U.S. military, and he'd only sat in Strikers and Bradleys, the U.S. frontline infantry fighting vehicles, a handful of times. All those occasions were during training evolutions at military bases around the United States, or a few times when in Iraq and Afghanistan working operations with the CIA's Special Activities Division. Normally, his ground branch task force helicoptered into a location to grab or eliminate their target, and they'd leave the same way. When they did travel over roads, they normally did so in low-profile vehicles, local cars, and trucks. The Special Activities Division left the driving around in big, bouncy, armored vehicles to the military guys. Court did not want to be here, working with mercenaries who were themselves working for a militia that was working for the evil Azzam regime. But he knew of no other way to get up near Palmyra, the place where Azzam was allegedly visiting Tuesday. He had to continue on this mission, to remain in cover as a mercenary deploying to support combat troops. And then, when he got as close as he could to his real destination, he would find a way to pick up the intel that would pinpoint Azzam's location. For this, he would need a phone, and he knew Van Wyck didn't have one, but there would be a Desert Hawk's command post wherever they were deploying, and there would be all the commo gear there he needed. In his fantasies, Court imagined his intel would send a squadron of French Mirage fighter bombers over Palmyra to take out Azzam from the air. But in reality, he was under no illusions the French would do anything so brazen. No, if this was to work, it would involve indigenous forces. In the meantime, however, the KWA men around him seemed very certain they were heading into some sort of a fight, although whether it was going to be a two-sided affair, with people fighting back, was as yet unknown. Court would be going in with them, doing what he had to do to keep his cover. But the first chance he got to acquire some actionable intel about the reasons behind this security option, grab some means of communication, and get the fuck out of there, he told himself he would take it. Court took off his helmet and rubbed the sweat already soaking his hair. Putting it back on, he met Saunders's gaze, and the British man leaned forward and spoke into his ear.
When we get where we're going, you're gonna have to do your job.
You doubt my abilities?
If we make contact with armed fighters?
No. I know you can do it.
Although, if it's not ISIS or al-Nusra, you'll probably whine about it before, during, and after. But the Hawks like to use us for suppression ops, and that means dirty work. If they send us into the city to round up town leaders or anti-regime suspects, I'll warn you, it won't make for stories you'll want to tell your grandkids by the fire.
Court just shrugged at Saunders, still trying to figure out the psychology of a man like him. He said,
"This is KWA, Lars Klossner's company. I knew what I was getting into on the way in."
Saunders nodded at this, and then said,
"How much you getting paid for the kid?"
Court pulled a number out of his ass.
$100,000.
Dollars?
Pesos.
Saunders's face showed genuine confusion. Court rolled his eyes.
"Yes, dollars."
The Englishman stared him down for several seconds.
"Bollocks. Wouldn't be worth it to a man like you. You've got a lifetime of training. You're not Canadian, you're a Yank, so I figure you for SEAL Team 6 or one of those Delta boys. Maybe even CIA para-ops.
You've got one hell of an imagination.
Saunders shook his head and repeated himself.
Bollocks. I bet you're making 200 minimum, which means I want 50.
Not gonna happen.
Saunders turned to the team leader at the far end of the bench.
Oi! Van Wyk!
The older South African turned to Saunders.
35, Court said.
50.
A sigh.
Fine.
Still with his eyes on the American, Saunders said,
Never mind, boss.
Van Wyk went back to his thoughts, and Saunders smiled at Court. The Englishman said,
I want to know more about you. I get that the money's nice in this line of work, but it's only worth it if you don't have other options. Me? I'm what they refer to as unemployable in the security and private military contractor industry. And since I don't have any other skills other than fighting, I took the job for KWA 5 years ago knowing what I would have to do. I told myself I'd follow orders for whoever I was working for, full stop. They want me to fight insurgents? Jolly good. If they want me to blast my way into a mosque and shoot a village elder, then I'll do that as well.
Court looked away.
But you? I don't have you sorted out yet. It's mad, really. Why the risk? Why not stay wrapped up in your bed at home when you're not fighting the good fight for your country and not out here in the shite with the Alibabas?
Court had been thinking the same thing about Saunders, but he didn't reveal it. Instead, he said,
Look, man, if you're trying to be my guidance counselor, you're about 20 years too late.
Saunders kept a skeptical eye on Court, who found the look unnerving. Finally, the Brit said,
Something got switched off in you, and you ended up here, flinching children. What was it?
Finally, Court said,
Here's where you and me stand, Saunders. I owe you some money, but I don't owe you any explanations. For anything.
Court leaned forward, menacing.
Now, get the fuck out of my face, and let me get some rest.
Saunders raised an eyebrow, and then he leaned back and away. Court closed his eyes and hoped the bouncing and knocking of the armored infantry carrier would somehow rock him to sleep. Chapter 56. The Frenchman tossed back the dregs of his fifth coffee of the day, and it wasn't even 10 a.m. He'd spent the morning in his office in the 5th arrondissement, working his satellite phone while the one suit he had with him dried in the window. He'd come here directly after hitchhiking away from the farmhouse because he was too tired and overwhelmed to conduct a surveillance detection route in order to make sure he hadn't been followed from the property. He didn't want to go home without being assured he hadn't been followed, but there was reasonably good security in the office building where he worked, so he decided that would be sufficient protection. He'd slept for 5 hours on his leather sofa, but by 8 a.m. he had a pot of coffee on the burner, his laptops opened, and his phone wedged between his neck and his ear, and since then, he'd been talking almost non-stop to various intelligence operatives in Jordan. These were exactly the men he knew would not agree to extract the son of Ahmed Azam when they learned about the death of Bianca Medina, but they were men who would do damn near anything to bring about the end of the Azam regime. So, if rescuing the baby and the nanny from Syria was the purchase price for the death of the dictator to their north, the Jordanians would find a way to come through. Originally, they had been asked to do nothing more than pick up the kid and the asset at their northern border, but now Voland was asking for something several orders of magnitude more complicated. He told the Jordanians he thought he could persuade a man to drive to the border to deliver a woman and the child, but this man wouldn't be trained in cross-border movements, personal recovery, or any sort of intelligence tradecraft at all. In short, the man who would be delivering the two subjects to the Syrian-Jordanian border wouldn't have a single skill necessary to facilitate this difficult and dangerous act, other than the ability to drive a car. So the Jordanians would have to somehow pick up all the slack on their end. The Jordanians would come through, Voland felt confident, but they'd need a couple of days to plan and put the assets in place. He did not want to reach out to Dr. Siddiqui until he knew exactly when and exactly how he was going to get the girl and the baby out of Syria. But he knew he needed to have a plan by the time the gray man contacted him, because he'd let the American down so many times already that nothing short of imminent action was going to convince him to keep up his end of the bargain and provide intelligence about Azam's movements. Voland also had contacts in the SDF, the coalition of predominantly Kurdish anti-regime groups fighting in the northern part of Syria, as well as in the Sunni-dominated Free Syrian Army. These connections came via the Halabis, but Voland knew if he did get the actionable intelligence from the Grey Man that he'd promised, the groups fighting Azzam would do anything in their power to attempt to exploit it. Once he felt he'd done all he could for now on the Jamal Medina front, his thoughts turned to a new topic, a topic he told himself he would do well to put out of his mind, but a topic he could not, in spite of himself, force himself to ignore. Sebastian Drexler. Vincent Voland had spent years looking for information that would lead to the capture of Drexler. It was a job he'd begun while working in foreign intelligence. There were domestic warrants aplenty for Drexler in France, and the Domestic Intelligence Service turned to foreign intelligence for help in locating and planning the man's capture, since it was clear Drexler was outside Europe. But when Voland left active service with DGSE, he continued his hunt for Drexler as something of a passionate hobby. The word was that Drexler had been living in Syria for 2 years, and he was doing the bidding of the regime, specifically focused on the private wealth of the Azzams. The rumors had come out of Switzerland, but they were just rumors, and no specific bank had been positively pegged as the location of the Azzams' money. When Voland had received word of the contacts between Drexler and ISIS in Brussels, he knew Drexler was indeed in Syria, indeed working for Shakira, and he came up with a plan to draw him out. That plan had worked as far as Phase 1, but Phase 2, the capture of Drexler, and Phase 3, the exploitation of Bianca Medina as an intelligence source for rebels fighting against the regime in Syria, had both failed as badly as any intelligence operation could possibly fail, and Vincent Voland put all blame for this on himself. That was why his thoughts were now locked on Drexler, where he was now, what his next play was. With Medina dead, Voland assumed Drexler would head back to Syria. Malik, on the other hand, was a European theater operative for the Syrian government, and he would likely stay somewhere on the continent in a safe house. He'd melt back into Europe's massive Arab population and disappear. The Syrian assassin had probably been here on the continent for years, so finding him with the scant clues Voland had would be difficult if not impossible. But Drexler had come here to Europe within a specific date range. He would most likely be leaving the continent soon, and this, Voland felt sure, presented him with an opportunity. He made a series of calls to acquaintances in French domestic intelligence and pulled some strings to have them download images from French immigration control. He specified time parameters that made safe assumptions about when Drexler arrived from Syria. Voland felt sure Drexler was not in Paris until after the ISIS attack on Thursday, and he must have arrived at the latest Saturday afternoon to be involved with the attack on the farmhouse late Saturday night. He requested images and passport information of all white males between ages 35 and 55, knowing Drexler was in his 40s, but might have tried to disguise himself in person, on his passport, or both. He requested the pulls from Charles de Gaulle, Orly, Marseille, and Lyon, the most suitable airports for someone coming from abroad, although Voland didn't even know for certain Drexler would have flown into France. He could have traveled through Brussels, Frankfurt, Amsterdam, or even farther away and taken a high-speed train. But Voland knew he had to start somewhere, and he also knew from his study of the man over the years that Drexler was an exceedingly assured, almost cocky, intelligence asset. He'd formulate and execute a plan straight up the middle of an intelligence operation. He wasn't a risk-taker per se, but instead a man with absolute confidence in his skills, borne out by years of success. Voland figured Drexler wouldn't have snuck into the country on a fishing trawler in the dead of night. No, he'd fly first class with papers to back him up all the way. At 11 a.m., he received a file with all 4,974 immigration arrival photos he'd requested. At 8 minutes till noon, he scrolled to the 1,303rd image. He continued to the 1,304th, but then he scrolled back. He shouted in his office, "Voila!" Voland had spoken at length to Drexler the evening before, so there was no mistaking the face. Sebastian Drexler had arrived at Charles de Gaulle on Saturday afternoon under a Finnish passport carrying the name of Viti Takala. The scanned passport photo was in a thumbprint size below the image taken when Drexler passed through immigration, and Voland enlarged it. The picture showed a bearded man with sandy brown hair, several shades darker than Drexler's, but noticeably so, because while Drexler's hair was short, the Takala passport showed a man with much longer hair and a full beard. Still, Volan could see that the passport photo was not Sebastian Drexler. The 65-year-old Frenchman picked up the phone and dialed the number of a friend in the DGSE, intending to have him run the name for any details on the passport or identity of Viti Takala. While the phone rang, Volan spent his wait Googling the name, on the off chance he'd find a social media account that matched the passport photo. And then he put the phone down. The name Volan entered into Google appeared in a Reuters article that had posted the previous day. Viti Takala was a photographer for ITN who had disappeared in Damascus 2 days earlier. The photo of the man clearly matched the passport photo that Drexler used. It occurred to Vincent Voland that if he were a betting man, he'd bet against Viti Takala ever making it back home to Helsinki. Curious as to how Drexler could have entered Europe using a false passport, he scanned through all the immigration data in the file sent by his intelligence agency contacts and saw that the fingertip reader recorded a match for the fingerprints on record for the Finn. Volan did not understand this at all, but he did realize it didn't matter. Drexler wouldn't be leaving the continent going through immigration control or using the passport of Viti Takala. No. He'd used that means once, and he'd surely burned the passport as soon as he got into the country. For Voland, this wasn't about finding out what name he was traveling under. This entire exercise was simply to acquire the one thing Voland needed above all else to find Sebastian Drexler before he left Europe. A close-in, high-resolution color photo of his face. The photograph taken by immigration at Charles de Gaulle was perfect, and it was of Drexler, not Takala. Drexler would have no time to change his appearance much, or at all, before he left the continent again. Voland had two missions now, and he was fully engaged in both. He told himself he would not rest until he got the kid and the nanny out of Syria, and he would not rest until he found Sebastian Drexler, and made him pay for what he'd done. Chapter 57. From a dead sleep, the sounds and the movement of the infantry fighting vehicle came to him in a rush, and then Kurt's eyes opened as he woke, with the taste of grease and fuel in his mouth. He wiped his sweat-drenched face with a towel he had jammed in his load-bearing vest, swigged warm water from a plastic bottle in his pack, and splashed more onto his face and down the back of his neck. He looked down at his rubber watch and synchronized the bouncing of his head with the swinging of his arm so he could focus on the numbers on the display. It was noon. He figured he'd slept on and off for close to 4 hours, which meant he'd really needed it. And it also meant the Desert Hawks Brigade convoy should be getting close to their destination. The BMP drove along a poorly maintained road. This Kurt could tell from the jarring bumps, but he couldn't see anything from his position. He looked over closer to the rear hatches and saw that Van Wyck was on the headset that allowed him to communicate with the vehicle's three-man crew, and he was struggling to write something down on a notepad propped on his knee. Saunders was awake next to him, and he caught Kurt's eye. The two men looked at each other, but neither spoke. Just then, Kurt heard a boom outside the vehicle, and he looked around to see that the other men in the back of the infantry fighting vehicle were all reacting to the same sound. It was either a large weapon firing or a shell detonating, and though it wasn't much louder than the noise of the machine surrounding him, he figured it had to have been pretty loud for them to hear it at all. Another boom, then another. Van Wyck shouted to the men around him.
That's outgoing! 100 millimeter!
The main weapon of the Russian-built BMP-3 was the 2A-70 launcher, a 100 millimeter gun that could fire high-explosive or anti-tank missiles. Kurt found himself hoping Ali Company of the Desert Hawks, the company he and his team were embedded with, had not come into contact with tanks, because the gray man had no magic ninja fighting solution to avoid getting blown up the same as everyone else. If the BMP Kurt was riding in was hit with an anti-tank round, Kurt's body would just turn into canned beef stew along with the other 8 guys in the vehicle. Seconds later, Kurt heard the unmistakable sound of heavy machine guns firing, and his feeling of helplessness and claustrophobia only increased.
Outgoing, Bras confirmed.
The 30 millimeter gun on Kurt's BMP joined the fray, and the sound was deafening. The team leader put his hand on his headset to press it closer to his ear, and he spoke to the driver of the vehicle for several more seconds. He looked up and said,
"Look alive! We're heading into an oil refinery 1 kilometer square. 2 dozen buildings in all either partially damaged or completely destroyed. Opposition presence is unknown, but Ali Company is taking some small arms fire from some of the structures. Our target is the central control building in the middle of the complex. It has been used as an SAA command post in the past. Daesh took over the refinery last month, and SAA intel is guessing Daesh will be using the same building as their HQ. We're being sent in to clear it so the Hawks can use it as their battalion CP for the clearing operation," Saunders said.
"Why don't the Hawks do this shit themselves?"
"They are sending Bashar and Chadli companies one click north to hit an enemy encampment in the hills. Ali Company is with us, but they will secure the other refinery structures while we clear the central control building,"
Braz said.
"This is grunt work, boss. And you're getting paid 50 times what any of those grunts are getting paid. So, put on your helmet and deal with it. Ali Company only has one platoon of special forces, and they are hitting the 3 pumping stations."
Cort could see on the faces of the others that none of the KWA men seemed interested in this fight, but they all tightened straps, took last swigs of water, and hefted their weapons. Van Wyck said,
"Our crews will deploy smoke ahead. Both of our BMPs will get us up to the building. We'll go at the rear hatches and continue straight on for 25 meters to the door of the target building. From there, we will clear the building bottom up."
It was a suffocating feeling for Cort to have someone relay second-hand info about the area right outside the armor from where he sat. An area he was about to attack into. He couldn't see a thing now, and he didn't imagine he would see the location he was hitting at all until he crawled out through the rear hatch. Anders shouted to be heard over the 30-cal firing above his head.
"Are the BMPs taking fire from the control building?"
Van Wyck spoke into his mic, then addressed the team again.
"Unknown, but the gunner reports possible movement on the 3rd floor of the building."
Fun, Cort thought. After rolling for hours with his knees to his chest, he was about to bound out through a smoke screen and race into a building that might be full of ISIS fighters. But the movement reported could also have been non-combatants. Cort eyed the men around him and told himself he wouldn't put it past any one of them to commit an atrocity or two before nightfall today. Cort heard the outgoing pops of smoke being deployed via grenade launchers on the turret of the BMPs, and then the vehicle stopped so violently that at first Cort thought it had taken a hit from an RPG. The BMP then turned 180 degrees on one of its tracks, lurched backwards a few feet, then stopped roughly again. The main gunner began firing the PKT vehicle-mounted machine gun, at what, Cort had no idea.
"Go!"
Van Wyck shouted. Anders opened the left rear hatch, and Braz opened the right. Cort was the third man out on the left. His boots crashed down into broken bits of concrete big enough to break an ankle if he didn't watch what he was doing. But he ran on through it, into thick gray smoke spewing from the grenades fired from his BMP. It was hard to tell with all the machine gun fire from his vehicle, but Cort didn't detect any incoming rounds as he made his way through the smoke. Soon, all he could see was Saunders's back and helmet ahead of him, and in seconds, he slammed with Saunders and the others against the wall of the building, flattening their backs out so they couldn't be seen by a shooter inside any of the shattered windows. They were next to the door, or at least next to where the door used to be. Instead, there was a massive hole where it looked to Cort like a main gun round from a tank had blown the door and a good portion of the wall away. But Cort hadn't heard any of the Desert Hawks T-72s firing, and he didn't see any tanks around now. So, if this had been from a tank, it had been a battle fought earlier. This was Syria, so for all Cort knew, the destruction could have been 7 years old. Cort stacked up at the back of the 6-man team, and seconds later, a half dozen KWA mercs from the other BMP appeared through the smoke and arrived at the other side of the big hole. Together the team breached the building. Van Wyck's 6 went right, and the other KWA unit went to the left. The first few rooms downstairs were empty, other than tons of trash and broken bits of concrete and glass. But Cort saw sleeping mats, tea kettles, clothes, and other evidence that someone had been living here in the rubble. He didn't see any weaponry or ammunition, or even anything in the clothing that gave him the impression there was some sort of military unit encamped here. Anders took point as the team moved up a set of cement stairs. Cort was still in back, But at the top of the staircase, Venwick sent Saunders, Braz, and Anders on to continue straight down the hall towards an open room ahead, while he directed Cort and Brunetti to follow him down the hall to the right. Cort liked Vanwick's thinking from a tactical aspect. There were few people on Earth with more close-quarters battle experience than Cort Gentry, and he knew that when room-clearing a building, if you don't have the manpower to leave an operator in each room you clear, you must consider the room enemy territory as soon as you leave it behind. With only 6 men clearing this wing of the building, it made sense to clear close proximity open spaces simultaneously to reduce the risk of the enemy backfilling the rooms they'd already been through. The hall to the right led to an office with a broken door that wasn't completely detached, so Brunetti shouldered it down while Cort and Vanwick flooded in to the left and right, respectively. Cort found the left side of the office to be nothing but a wrecked collection of filing cabinets and broken desks, but before he could call clear, he heard gunfire right behind him. He spun around, dropping to his left knee pad as he did so, and he saw a man with a sniper rifle at the wrecked window of the office. He'd been shot multiple times already by Vanwick, but somehow he was still on his feet. Gentry, Vanwick, and Brunetti all fired into the man, throwing him back into the corner of the room. He spun against the wall and fell forward onto his face. Cort had no idea if he'd just killed a Free Syrian Army soldier or a member of ISIS. Just like the day before on the highway, his survival instincts superseded everything else. They cleared the rest of the room, a hall that ran off the back to the bathroom, and then the bathroom itself. On the way back through the office, Cort stepped over to the body and rolled the man over. He was bearded, with long hair and a black t-shirt. An old brown sling full of rifle magazines hung around his neck. Cort said, "Looks like ISIS." Brunetti reformed tight behind Vanwick to continue clearing the rest of the building. At the doorway, he said, "Everybody looks like ISIS around here to me." Cort reformed at the back of the group, and the three moved along the western end of the second floor of the control center building and prepared to go up a metal staircase to rejoin the other three men. But just as they started to climb, a burst of automatic gunfire erupted at the top of the stairs. Quickly, Vanwick, Brunetti, and Cort moved up in a tight three-man stack. They found a hallway with a pair of doorways at the end. Vanwick called out, "Coming in!" Saunders replied instantly, "All clear, we're on the right!" Cort followed the other two into a large room. At the far corner, Saunders stood over a group of bodies lying by the window. "What you got?" Vanwick asked.
"3 dead."
"Combatants?"
Saunders spit on the floor.
"Enemy sympathizers."
Cort lowered his weapon a little and walked across the room to the bodies. 2 women wearing hijabs, both in their 20s, were perforated from their collarbones to their pelvises. A 3rd body was of a boy no more than 14. He had taken a round through the stomach. Blood splattered the wall low behind them, giving Cort the impression they had all been sitting on the floor when they were shot. The 3 had been living in this wrecked storage room. That was clear from the blankets and boxes of crackers and trash and the 2 half-empty plastic jugs of water nearby. None of the 3 had any weapons, Cort could see.
"You motherfuckers!"
Cort couldn't help it. He said it out loud. He knelt to check for a pulse on the boy.
"What are you doing?"
Braz asked from across the room. Cort did not reply. The boy was dead, and the ladies appeared dead as well, but he began checking them both for a pulse. Vanwick said,
"Kilo 9 is new here. You boys popped your cherries once. You'll get used to it."
After a moment, Vanwick called out to Cort.
"That's enough, 9. Come on. A lot of rooms to check."
Reluctantly, Cort climbed back up to his feet and rejoined the mercs, his jaw flexing as he thought about flipping his weapon to fully automatic fire and gunning down all 5 of these men from behind. But he didn't flip his selector switch, and he didn't fire. Instead, he spoke to himself. "Stay in cover, Gentry. Stay in cover and end this fucking war." Chapter 58. President of the Syrian Arab Republic, Ahmed al-Azam, smiled, looked into the eyes of his beautiful wife Shakira, and kissed her sweetly. They hugged tenderly, and then they both looked up to a point across the room. Ahmed wore a blue pinstripe suit, warm in the hot lights around him, and a thin sheen of perspiration glistened on his forehead, despite the makeup he wore. He spoke in his native tongue.
Shakira and I have been blessed with a beautiful family, wonderful friends, and work that we both find fulfilling. While ours is a happy life, many of our fellow countrymen are less fortunate. You know I am engaged tirelessly keeping Syrians prosperous and safe from terrorists and foreign invaders, but you should also know that my lovely wife works day and night on the social programs that help the impoverished among us live healthy and gratifying lives.
Shakira took her husband's hand and squeezed it tightly.
Thank you, darling. We hope you will all join us in making a contribution to the First Lady's Children First Anti-Poverty Campaign by calling the number on your screen now. Operators are standing by, ready to receive your donations.
Ahmed put his arm around his wife and looked into the same camera. Together they said,
Shukran jazalan.
Thank you very much. The lights flipped off, the director called cut, and the Azams unfolded from their embrace without another glance towards each other. Shakira stood from the sofa in the main reception room of the palace to speak with her assistant, while Ahmed launched from the sofa himself, stepped over to his bodyguards, and left the room without a glance or a word to anyone, least of all his wife. In the long corridor that would take him back to his office, he felt his phone vibrate in his coat pocket. He answered it.
Yes? Ahmed? Ahmed, it's me.
His eyes narrowed as he heard Bianca's voice. The facial expression belied a look of mistrust, but his own voice carried a light and thankful tone.
How wonderful to hear you. How are you feeling, my darling? Thanks to God, I am safe. Your men rescued me last night. I'm sorry I was too exhausted to talk when they freed me. My emotions had been so strained over the last days.
Ahmed stepped over to a huge window that looked out over the gargantuan 30-acre front court of the palace grounds. As he did so, he waved his guards and attendants away. He spoke softer now.
Were you hurt in any way? No, Ahmed. I was locked in a basement, but I was fed, attended to. I managed to escape just as your men attacked. The terrorists holding me tried to burn me to death, so I'm glad I was able to get out in time. Yes, I heard. Very fortunate for you.
It was silent for a few seconds. Then Bianca said,
When will I see you, my love? The men who are with you now are competent. They will bring you home to me soon, inshallah. Good. I can't wait to return to you and Jamal.
Ahmed analyzed every word Bianca said, each inflection, each breath he could hear.
Bianca, what did you tell your captives?
Tell them. I told them nothing.
Nothing? Did you mention anything about Jamal, perhaps? It is all right if you did. I just must know so I can keep him protected.
I said nothing. Not a word. Why? Is something wrong?
Azam did not know if something was wrong. He couldn't detect a lie over a satellite phone. No, he needed to see his lover face to face to find out if she had told the terrorists about the existence of her son and where she lived.
Nothing is wrong. Everything is just right, now that you have been rescued.
Good, she said. When I get off the phone with you, I will call Yasmin.
Ahmed's narrow expression of mistrust returned. He said,
I have ordered Yasmin and Jamal moved for their safety, and there is no phone where they are. You will see them as soon as you return.
Yes, all right.
Come home to me. We have much to discuss.
Yes, love. Inshallah.
Ahmed hung up the phone and adopted an impassive expression for the benefit of the men across the corridor. But in truth, his body steamed with rage. His child had been taken from his city, and it would be days before he knew if his mistress was involved in the crime. But for now, he had to hurry to the airport. His flight north to Homs to appear at an Iranian base would be tomorrow, and then, the next morning, he would go to Palmyra, to a Russian facility on the edge of the desert. He didn't want to go to these places. His son, the heir to his reign here in Syria, was missing. And even though he had thousands of police and internal intelligence officers looking for him, while this was going on, it was hard for Ahmed to focus on other matters. And doubly so because of Bianca. When she came home, he was going to have her visited by his best intelligence interrogators, under the guise of asking about her captors. But the real objective of his people would be to find out if she had any culpability, either in her disappearance or in Jamal's disappearance. His people had been extracting the truth from terrorists, rebels, dissidents, turncoats, and political rivals for a long time. They would find the truth from beautiful Bianca, and if the truth was what he feared, he would have her tortured and then executed for her disloyalty. As he walked back to his office, he decided he might even take part in the torture himself. Bianca Medina did her best to keep from crying. She handed the satellite phone back to Malik, who stood there with Drexler and the French police officer, who clearly did not understand a word of Arabic. After sleeping through the morning, Bianca had asked to call Yasmin, but Malik reminded her that the president himself was waiting to hear from her. She did her best to sound innocent, to reveal nothing about the Halabis, the American killer, the French spy. But she did not think Ahmed believed her. She did not believe him for a moment that Yasmin and Jamal had been moved to somewhere secure, no. The American had taken them, and that was why Ahmed was suspicious of her. Ahmed had determined the truth, that she had told her captors everything. If she returned to Syria, she would be killed. This she knew without a shadow of a doubt. But she saw no opportunity to get away from the men who held her now. She did not believe she would ever see her son again, and she did not believe she was safe in Europe, or safe at home. She returned to her cot amid the hanging bedsheets, and she sat down, and there, she could hold it no longer. She started to cry. Malik and Drexler watched the woman cry alone for a moment, and then they turned away and stepped into an office in the warehouse building to talk. Drexler knew all about the kidnapping of Bianca's son from Shakira, but Malik knew nothing about the child, even of his existence. All he knew were his orders, to get Drexler and Bianca back to Syria. And he knew that this plan had hit a stumbling block. Drexler said, "You told me we'd go to the airport at noon. It's 5 till. Malik said, "I had one of my men go to Tassous Le Noble. He says French military troops have arrived and are searching it top to bottom. They are setting up tents off the tarmac, preparing for a longer stay. We won't be flying out of there." Drexler rubbed his face in frustration. Malik said, "You shouldn't have left Volund alive. This is his doing." Drexler shook his head. "No, it's not. I wanted a peaceful resolution so we could exfiltrate France quietly. Volund did his best to give that to us. But the massacre and the fire that could be seen from a jumbo jet, that is what brought the authorities out en masse." Malik turned away. "I have my men acquiring some vans. We will drive east, not to Serbia. I don't feel confident in the private flight to Russia any longer." "Why not?" Malik shrugged. "Again, you left Volund alive. I think he will be involved in the search for us. He could have distributed photos of Bianca everywhere, even to a small airport in Serbia. So, where are we going?" "We will go to Athens, and then..." "Athens, Greece? That's a 24-hour drive!" Drexler shouted. Malik kept his voice calm. "We will drive for 24 hours. When we arrive in Athens, we will wait for a ship to pick us up. You, Bianca, and I will travel to the Syrian coast." "What is this ship?" "It's been used in smuggling operations for years, but right now it is off the coast of Lebanon. A dozen of my Mukhabara colleagues working in Beirut will board today, and it will make the 2-day crossing to Athens, where it will meet us." Drexler thought this over. He wasn't getting on board that ship, obviously, but he saw how this change of plans might work to his advantage.
"When do we go?" Drexler asked. "We will leave here within the hour."
Malik looked over at Savage, sitting and smoking at the front-loading dock of the warehouse.
"What about the cop?" "He will come with us. He might be useful," Drexler said. "I'll see that he earns all the money that I have promised him, even if he never lives to see a cent of it."
Chapter 59. At the refinery in central Syria, Van Wyck finally announced the all-clear to his KWA mercenaries, after 20 minutes searching the control building. In all that time, the two KWA teams found a grand total of 3 armed enemy, the one Venwick sighted in the first room, and a sniper spotter team on the roof that was killed by the men from the other BMP. While this was going on, there had been a lot of shooting taking place all over the refinery as an entire company of Desert Hawks Brigade militia, some 200 men, took outbuildings, pumping stations, storage facilities, and other structures. But Cort couldn't tell much from the cadence of the fire. It could have been that the Desert Hawks were involved in multiple skirmishes with the enemy in different parts of the massive property, or it could have been that they were simply executing civilians they found hiding in the ruins. As soon as the control building was clear, the battalion command of the Desert Hawks Brigade began pulling up in trucks, armored personnel carriers, and other vehicles. As the building had been used as an HQ by the Syrian Arab Army when they owned the refinery, there was already space for them to move their equipment into. 3 large command center rooms on the second floor were used to bring in communications equipment, maps, headquarters staff, and senior officers, while a platoon of security was positioned on the roof and in the large building's windows. The 12-man KWA strike force climbed back in their BMPs to catch up with the main element of Desert Hawks Brigade. But when they didn't move out after 20 minutes, Venwick got on the radio with company command and found out that Ali Company had been ordered to halt here at the refinery to await further instructions. The mercenaries filed out of the vehicles again, went back into the command building, and found a shattered, ruined office with blasted-out windows on the top floor in which to wait. The body of a man well into his 50s, perhaps even his 60s, lay in the center of the room. Blood splatter on the floor told the story. He'd been engaged from the doorway. The blood was fresh, so Cort knew it was someone on the KWA team that shot him. The body wore a simple white button-down and brown slacks. He wasn't geared up in any way as a fighter, and there was no weapon nearby. Cort couldn't say for certain this man had been a non-combatant, and for all he knew, the dead man had charged right at the men who came through the door. But Cort seriously doubted it. From what he'd seen and heard of KWA, he assumed this man had just been squatting here in the building and was shot dead while unarmed by the mercenaries who encountered him. When the team moved into the office, Saunders and Braz picked up the body in the middle of the room, dragged it over to the blasted-out window, and swung it out, letting it drop down onto the concrete below. Cort just looked away. Venwick had been with the Desert Hawks leadership in the command post to find out the reasons for the delay, and now he leaned his head into the room.
Bashar and Chandli companies are heavily engaged to the northeast. They think it's FSA, company strength at most, but well dug into the hills. Nothing for us to do. It's long-range engagement, snipers and mortars and RPGs. Definitely not the CQB stuff they use us for. The militia is calling for the Syrian Air Force for assets to disrupt the enemy in the hills, but so far, nothing's available. We're to wait here at Battalion HQ for orders, but I don't expect it will be long before the Hawks need us. I'll be downstairs in the CP.
The rest of the 12-man team found places to sit or lie down around this ruined office. Cort took off his rifle and his backpack and leaned against the wall. He was still fuming about the murder of the non-combatants, but he knew the sooner he focused his attention on his real mission here, the sooner he'd be done with these KWA assholes. And he was well aware that being positioned here near the Hawks Brigade command post had presented him with an opportunity. Cort knew he needed to find a way downstairs into the CP. There would be maps, plans, men discussing the tactical needs of this security operation, and somewhere in all that intelligence, Cort was hopeful he'd find some information about Ahmed Azam's rumored trip to Palmyra. Sure, Cort was embedded with one militia unit that, from what he had been told, had been positioned at the outer edge of the security ring around Palmyra. It was too much to hope for that that tactical operations center for the Desert Hawks Brigade was going to have all the plans for the entire operation laid out for him to see, but he didn't necessarily need to know everything. He was looking for a definite time and an exact place, and he would love to know as much as he could about the security setup for the president during his visit. He had no illusions that he'd learn everything he needed to know. Still, he'd take whatever he could get, and he'd make the most of it, but first, he needed a way to get into the TOC. Cort had been thinking this over for several minutes, lost in his thoughts, when he looked up and saw Braz leaning back on his backpack, sitting on the floor by the wall, and staring at him from across the room. Kort looked away, but the Croatian mercenary said,
"What's your problem, Kilo Nine?"
"Go fuck yourself," Kort answered. Saunders was sitting nearer to the window. He said,
"Don't worry about him, Braz. The new bloke will come through when the fight is on." "Yeah? Sounds like he wants to do an interview with every son of a bitch in every firefight before deciding whether they get a bullet. Is this asshole going to have my back when he sees some lady pull out a pistol on my six? I don't trust him."
Kort turned back to the Croatian. "So, you don't trust the guy who doesn't shoot innocent kids? Are all you guys that twisted?" Saunders gave Kort an eat shit look, while some of the others mumbled curses Kort's way. But Braz was the one who stood up from his position. He left his M4 rifle on the floor where he'd been sitting, but he walked over to Kort. Kort stood up and faced him. Braz said,
"You're a little better than the rest of us, aren't you, Wade?"
"I didn't come here thinking that, but you guys aren't impressing me much with your actions."
Braz stuck a finger in Kort's face.
"Bastards who look just like those three we shot downstairs wear S-vests all the time."
"Which three? You mean the boy and the two ladies? I didn't see any S-vests on them."
"I've lost men to women and kids before. You might not have to worry about that in Toronto or wherever the fuck you come from. But you're in the real world out here in the desert."
"So, what? You just shoot everybody you see to be sure?"
Braz said,
"That would suit me. God'll sort them out. Seriously, why are you here?"
Kort said,
"Maybe God sent me to sort you out."
Kort and Braz went for each other simultaneously, locking up and falling to the floor. Kort rolled on top of the bigger man, pinning him by his chest, but as Kort brought his fist back to deliver a punch to the man's face, the Croatian shifted his weight onto his right hip, shoved his right elbow inside Kort's knee, and bridged his body up, thrusting hard to the right. Kort knew judo. He knew the move Braz was trying to execute, and he knew how to counter it. He made to slide his left leg away from his body to stabilize himself so he couldn't get thrown, but as he moved his foot, he realized Braz had brought his own left leg over his own body, then hooked it down around Kort's foot, trapping his leg tight. Kort's weight was on his knees, not back at his feet where he could fight Braz's new leverage, so the Croatian easily flipped Kort off to the side, and Kort slammed down onto his back. Braz didn't hesitate to exploit his advantage. He rolled onto Kort, pinning his shoulders to the dusty concrete floor. He headbutted Kort, using his helmet in an attempt to break the pinned man's nose, but Kort's helmet blocked the brunt of the strike, so the Croatian changed tactics, sitting up to get enough distance to rain punches down on Kort's face with his hard-knuckled combat gloves. But as Braz postured up, Kort realized the danger he was in, so he moved with the man above him, shot his arms around Braz's body armor, and grabbed his own wrists behind the man's back. He pulled Braz back down close to him. Here, Kort used his right leg to trap Braz's left, used his right arm to overhook Braz's left shoulder, and clamped in tight. So when he pushed off the man, wouldn't be able to catch himself with his left hand on the floor. Kort exploded hard up with his left foot and let go of his grip behind Braz's back, sending the 200-pound man and all his gear rolling to his left, where he slammed onto his back. Kort rolled on top of Braz's torso, pancaking his shoulders to the floor. He felt Braz reach for something with his left hand down at his waist, so Kort himself used his left hand to reach for his own boot. Braz brought a fixed-blade knife from its scabbard and pressed its tip under Kort's body armor at his right hip. Simultaneously, Kort thumbed the button on his switchblade, springing the 4-inch blade like a bullet. Just as the Croatian began putting pressure on the knife at Kort's hip, Kort brought the razor-sharp edge of his switchblade up and against Braz's carotid artery. Both men froze in this position.
"I'll gut you," Braz said, "and then you'll bleed out right where you lay."
Kort turned his head to the sound of movement and saw Saunders leaping up to his feet from where he had been sitting and watching the fight. He charged over, reaching for his pistol on his leg as he moved. Kort kept his left hand and his knife's blade right where it was against Braz's neck, but he untucked his right arm from its clutch around Braz's head and fired it down to his right hip, over the knife jabbing into his lower back. In less time than Saunders could make two bounding steps towards the fight, Kort drew his SIG pistol, whipped it around and over his body, and pointed it at Saunders at a range of 10 feet. The Englishman stopped, raised his hands, and froze in place. And then Van Wyck stepped back into the room.
What the holy fuck is going on in here?
Both Braz and Gentry breathed heavily, but neither man moved their edged weapons from their lethal positions. Van Wyck shouted,
Knock it off! Wait! Braz!
Still, neither man moved. Court thought Braz was a psychopathic murderer. He wasn't about to relax his guard as long as the man had a knife pressing against him. Van Wyck realized this was a tense situation that had to be untangled the right way. The team leader said,
All right, first, Saunders, turn away and walk back over to your kit. Do it slowly, and Wade won't shoot you. That's right, isn't it, Kilo Nine?
That's right, Court said through labored breath, his pistol still aimed at the Brit's face.
Saunders lowered his hands, turned slowly away, and returned to where he was sitting.
Right, pistol down, Wade. Slide it over to me.
Court did as instructed, but kept the switchblade tight against Braz's neck. Van Wyck next said,
Brunetti!
The Argentine sat on his backpack near the window.
Yeah, boss? You got a dog in this fight?
No, boss.
Good. Raise your weapon. Shoot the first man who doesn't do as I tell them.
The man with the broken nose reached for his AK leaning against the wall. He leveled it at the two men lying together on the floor across the room, then flipped off the safety lever.
Okay,
Van Wyck said.
On three, you will both lower your weapons, unravel, and go back to your kit. One. Two. Brunetti, you good?
Yes, boss.
And three.
Court retracted his switchblade with a snap, and Braz dropped his knife to the floor next to him with an audible clang. Both men climbed to their knees without looking at each other, and then stood. Seconds later, their knives were restowed. Van Wyck kicked Court's pistol back to him, and the men sat down on opposite sides of the room. The South African team leader said,
That doesn't happen again, or I start killing men for the good of the mission. Now, I came up here to give you a sit rep. Companies Bashar and Chaudhry are moving into the northern hills. They've broken up the opposition lines there. Battalion command can't get any SAA air online to attack the FSA while they're on the move, so they are trying to reach out to the Russians. Either way, we'll be heading due east in 15 mics, bypassing the hills and staying on the highway. There is a town we have to take by dusk to get us into position for tonight.
Saunders asked, What's tonight?
Court noticed that Van Wyck glanced his way before saying,
Looks like a raid is in the works. That's all I know.
The team leader left the room, but Court climbed to his feet, grabbed his rifle, and followed along into the hall to the stairs there.
Sir,
the South African turned around at the top of the stairs.
Don't call me sir. It's boss, Van Wyck, or haymate.
Right, boss. Look. Sorry about that back there.
Van Wyck put a gloved finger in Court's face.
I've got enough to deal with. Don't let it happen again.
I won't.
Klausner told me you were good, but didn't have a lot of experience on the dark side. You'll learn not to love it, but you'll learn to do it.
This guy was as lost as the rest of these cutthroat killers, Court could see. He changed the subject.
You said they were trying to get Russian air to the hills?
That's right.
I speak Russian, if they need someone in the operations center.
Van Wyck seemed surprised by this, but said,
SAA has Russians embedded with them, but the Hawks don't. If the Hawks want Russian air, they've had to go through the army.
Maybe I can raise them on the radio directly.
Come with me, Van Wyck ordered.
Court went back to collect his gear, then followed Van Wyck without a look or a word to the other men. Chapter 60 After traveling from Damascus up to the interior of the nation, Court finally found himself about 25 feet away from where he really wanted to be. This was progress, yes, but he also found it frustrating as hell. He'd been led into the Desert Hawks Battalion command post on the second floor of the refinery control building, but he'd been moved along a wall and taken to a communication station at a long table in the corner. He stood there with Van Wyck and a few Desert Hawks captains and majors, but 25 feet off his right shoulder was an open and damaged doorway to another part of the command center, and right inside this room was a detailed map lying flat on a large table. The map appeared to Court to be the size of a twin bed, and militia officers moved around it, talking to one another and on handheld radios. He was certain the map held the secrets for whatever this security operation was all about, and if in fact an Azam visit to Palmyra was the reason behind the operation, then Court knew he needed to find his way into that room. Court stole glances over to the table every chance he got, but from his position he couldn't make out a single feature of the map. He had been standing here waiting for the radio man seated in front of him to dial in the Russian Air Force frequency that would put him directly in touch with Russian forces. It was weird, he had to admit. He was about to request that the Russians send air support to attack retreating Free Syrian Army forces. The thought made him feel nauseous, but he was in cover, and he'd seen no other way to finagle an invitation down into this room, where he knew he might be able to find the answers he was looking for. Court was in this mission all the way now. He'd do what he had to do to get the intel for the FSA that could target Azam personally. Finally, Van Wyck gave Court a long list of instructions relayed from the Syrian officers standing around the radio table, who themselves were in radio contact with the two companies pursuing the enemy forces to the north. When Court had everything written down, he took the radio and actuated the microphone. "Calling Russian air assets on this frequency. This is Desert Hawks Brigade Battalion Tactical Operations Center." Court gave the code name of the Hawks unit commander, as instructed by the Syrian officers standing around.
"Send your traffic, Hawks Brigade,"
came the terse reply in Russian. Court was working off a map in front of him, although it wasn't the map he wanted to see. On the table where the radio was set up was a laminated map with grease pencil notations, showing this command position in the refinery, the highway to the north, and the hills farther north where the FSA were running from the two regime militia companies. Court glanced at the map and said,
"We have enemy in the open, fleeing to the northeast. Request any air assets in the area to prosecute. How copy?"
There was a long wait before any reply, and when it came, it was a different Russian voice.
"Who is broadcasting on this network?"
the Russian asked. Court replied,
"I'm a contracted PMC officer for the Desert Hawks Brigade."
Court repeated the code words for the unit commander. There was a pause.
"You're not an Arab."
"That is correct. I am Canadian. Klausner Welt Ausbildung Security."
Another pause from the Russian.
"We have a Russian officer who speaks some Arabic. Put a Syrian on the radio."
Court translated this for Van Wyck and added,
"These Russians have something against Canadians, apparently."
Van Wyck translated for the Desert Hawks officers, and one of them got on the radio to speak with the Russian air assets. To Court, it looked like he'd just outlived his usefulness. There was a good chance he was going to be sent back to the KWA room upstairs because he wasn't needed here. He realized the only way he'd learn anything here in the command center was by walking into the other room and right up to the map. So he decided he needed to risk doing just exactly that. Van Wyck was engaged with the majors, and none of the other men in the commo room noticed him slip away. Court walked into the room with the map table like he had every right in the world to be there, and he judged the movement of the group of men around the table to position himself where he could see them most. The men were engaged in their conversation. Court wasn't picking up the words, but it seemed to be something of an argument. He walked the length of the room and through an open door on the far side. Here was a small empty room with a window, but no way out. It would be awkward to just turn around and retrace his steps, but he was the gray man. He knew he could pull it off. Court turned around and walked right back past the map, again as if he belonged, and headed back to the radio room. He'd spent fewer than 10 seconds close to the map, and had only looked at it for 2 or 3. But he saw what he needed to see. The map clearly displayed the city of Palmyra, and a series of concentric circles. Different unit markings were evident around the maps, although Court didn't recognize all the units. To the far east, it was easy to decipher because this part of the map was a much more detailed version of the smaller laminated map Court saw on the radio man's table. Court couldn't read the Arabic script, but he had seen the location of the Hawks' position in the refinery and also north in the hills. Court could also see that there were 2 more small towns to the east of the refinery along the highway. To the west were markings for other units, and from what Court had heard in the bar the night before, the SAA was providing the inner line of defense around the Palmyra area. Inside of the SAA protective ring, the nucleus of the entire map had not been drawn around the city of Palmyra itself, but instead, it looked like it was about a mile or a mile and a half outside the city. And the nucleus was not a circle. It looked like the outline of a dumbbell lying at a 45-degree angle. At the center of the entire map, the nucleus around which